Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I start with a quotation. Wright's talk is inherently aggressive, even imperial. It tends towards moral inflation and militates against accommodation. Wright's talkers, with their inner monologues of preemptive resentments, work themselves into a simmering state of annoyed vigilance against any limits on their willfulness, unquote. Well, that sounds very bad. That was written by George Will, if anybody reads his column, in a 2009 column in the Washington Post, the balance of which was a, so far as I can tell, spot-on account of life in the well-heeled suburban state of nature known as Chevy Chase, Maryland, but about the, on his view, excesses of Wright's talk and the focus to the exclusion of other things on Wright's in American political discourse. Will mentioned one of the most celebrated academic criticisms of Wright's talk. I mean, he's a popular commentator, but he mentioned a very celebrated academic criticism of Wright's talk, a book published in 1991 called Wright's Talk by Harvard Law professor and former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, Marianne Glendon. The conservative criticism of Wright's talk, so from the anti-Wright's talk from the right, one might say, conservative criticism of Wright's talk usually dilates on a kind of individualistic, agonistic, zero-sum politics, which is no politics at all, but what one might characterize as the remains of politics left behind by a community that has become rigidly legalistic and incapable of political deliberation. So there is the suggestion that rights, individual rights, are a modern idea connected, perhaps causally, with some of the characteristic problems of modern politics. Individualism that dilutes communal bonds and leads to the kind of lonely egoism identified by many social thinkers, but also a politics characterized by constant rancor and an unwillingness to compromise. That may or may not be an accurate description of our politics. Is it accurate in the proposition that the cause of Wright's talk, or the subject of Wright's talk, namely rights, is it really an accurate description of rights and what we mean by rights? And my answer is, it depends. Specifically, it depends on just how one understands rights and how one talks about rights. My rights talk is divided into four parts. First, I want to pose two more specific problems that quickly emerge when we apply ourselves to the question of rights in light of the problems noted by George Will and Marianne Glendon and many other people. Second, I want to make some distinctions about rights that concern the two fundamental questions about them, namely what rights are and what explains their existence. Third, I want to look at what seems to me the key texts in Aquinas on the question of rights. And fourth, very briefly, I want to suggest the lines of a Thomistic understanding of our practice of rights that I think goes a good bit towards mitigating the problems discussed by people like George Will and Marianne Glendon, and as I said, many other people, really. So I started with a quotation from George Will. Now, here's two other quotations. The first one I think you will recognize. If you don't, then I'll simply say that you are bad Americans, but I think you will recognize it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now everybody knows what that is, right? That's the words of the Declaration of Independence. It established the United States as a nation dedicated first and foremost to the protection of the fundamental rights of its people. Indeed, we can call these rights natural rights, since the Declaration refers to them not only as self-evident truths, but in the immediately preceding sentence, it refers to, quote, the laws of nature and of nature's God, unquote. The fundamental basis of American government, then, seems to be natural rights. Now consider a second quotation. Maybe you won't recognize this one, but maybe you will, from a document produced some 216 years after the Declaration of Independence. Quote, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state, unquote. It's the often quoted mystery passage. The late Justice Scalia used to refer to it as the sweet mystery of life passage. It's the mystery passage from the United States Supreme Court's opinion to Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was decided in 1992. In that case, the court reaffirmed the existence of a constitutional right to abortion. Of course, it's now been overturned by the Dobbs decision. Like the Declaration of Independence, then, that statement I read is fundamentally concerned with rights. But the similarity ends there. The Declaration, as I said, grounds itself in, quote, the laws of nature and of nature's God, unquote, which are, quote, self-evident truth. The Casey Court held, or so it seems on any plain reading, that there is a fundamental right, quote, to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, unquote. It's hard to know what to make of that passage, promulgated solemnly and authoritatively by our highest court, even as a matter of logic. How, for example, does one define a mystery? If it's a mystery, it seems like you can't define it, but if one can define one's own concept of meaning, does that not pose problems for anyone else's rights claims? How does one person recognize the rights of another person if one has a different concept of meaning than that person does? Moreover, I have to confess that even though I make my living as a professional student of philosophy, I shudder to think of what I would do if I were required to produce my own concept of the universe. I have no such concept. I look around and I see it. So the question here then is, what happened? What explains the transition from the Declaration of Independence's doctrine of natural rights, recognizable as self-evident truths, to Casey's right to define one's own universe? Clearly, something has changed. I said that they do have one thing in common, and that is that they both concern fundamental rights. This common element has led some to think that the change was in some sense foreordained. That if the country was founded on a doctrine of individual rights, the transition to a kind of radical individualism, a radical individualism that leads perhaps to relativism and perhaps even nihilism, was easy. We have arrived where we are because we began where we started. The discourse of individual rights is itself the culprit on this view. And this leads to the second problem that I want to notice. I said above that the critics of rights talk often identify it as a modern innovation, that in earlier ages in societies, political discourse was not, as it often is with us, about rights. In the ancient world, for example, there was much more talk about things like community, virtue, and duty, and very little, if any, talk about rights. So too with the medieval world, the world of St. Thomas Aquinas. Many influential historians of political and legal thought have argued that there is no doctrine of natural rights in the thought of Aquinas. Rather, Aquinas taught the doctrine of natural law. A very famous political philosopher who used to teach at Boston College, Ernest Fortin, used to say, "We have the Ten Commandments, not the Ten Rights." Right? And that expresses the difference. Aquinas taught the doctrine of natural law. Rights are understood by modern political thinkers to be a kind of individual sovereignty, a protected zone in which the individual is free to make whatever choices she wants about some matter. A constituent element of necessarily individual freedom and a kind of possession of individuals, like property. Law, however, restrains one's choices and so limits the sovereignty of the individual. Natural law is one thing, an ancient or medieval thing. Natural rights are something entirely different, a modern thing. Rights are about freedom. Laws are about constraint. And Aquinas, on this view, was very much on the constraint side. Natural rights emerge with the Enlightenment thinkers who rejected Thomistic moral thought. Among those Enlightenment thinkers was, most importantly for us Americans, John Locke. Several passages of the Declaration of Independence, written, of course, by Thomas Jefferson, are virtual quotations from Locke's Second Treatise of Government. If you ever And you should visit Virginia. You should visit frequently. If you ever come, you should go to Charlottesville. That's one of the places that you should wear this University of Virginia. And Jefferson's house, Monticello, is there, which you can tour, his beautiful house. And you can see in the room where Jefferson entertained people, portraits hanging very prominently, three portraits. One of them is a portrait of Francis Bacon. The second is a portrait of Isaac Newton. And the third is a portrait of John Locke, three of them hanging together. Jefferson called Bacon, Newton, and Locke, quote, my trinity of the greatest men the world has ever produced, unquote, in a letter that he wrote to a friend in 1811. Now, these two problems that I've mentioned at the beginning here are, I think, closely related, since the second aims to explain the first. If postmodernism is a reaction to modernism, then the Casey decision's seemingly insouciant postmodern view of rights is a natural development out of Jefferson's modern view of rights in the Declaration, grounded as it was in the Enlightenment's rejection of anything like Thomistic natural law. We have a very neat, if depressive, narrative here. Natural law is replaced by natural rights, which in turn yields to relativistic individualism. The narrative may be true as far as it goes, although it is certainly far too simplistic, but I want to leave this issue aside in favor of what seems to be the more important question moving forward. Did it have to work out that way, if we think that it did? Did it have to work out that way? Does the recognition of natural rights necessarily lead to individualism and perhaps relativism? And must it be at odds with natural law, as Aquinas understood it? Must we choose between natural law and natural rights? To begin to answer this question, we need to gain some clarity about just what we mean by a right and what explains the existence of rights. So that's the first part. So now the second part. I want to discuss these issues in turn, but first it's necessary to make explicit a distinction that I've been assuming. I've been speaking mainly about natural rights, but those aren't the only kinds of rights. By natural right, we usually mean a right to which one is entitled simply in virtue of being a human person. For Aquinas, of course, all humans are persons, but not all persons are human. God is a person, indeed three persons, and angels are persons. But there are also, in addition to natural rights, civil or legal rights, to which persons are entitled in virtue of some specific status established by practice or law. As we all know from watching reruns of Law and Order, you have a right to an attorney if you're arrested. But that isn't a natural right. It was established by the United States Supreme Court in a famous case called Gideon versus Wainwright, decided in 1963. You also have a right to remain silent if the police pick you up and question you about things, but that's not a natural right either. It was established in 1966 in a case called Miranda versus Arizona. Both natural rights and legal rights have certain features in common, which is important in what I'll say about the character of rights, but they are different, those two types, and it's the difference that matters most in discussing why there are rights at all. But first things first, what do I mean by a right? The most helpful analytical account of rights was actually produced by an American law professor, Wesley Newcomb Hofeld, who taught at Yale University Law School and lived from 1879 to 1918. He published a famous couple of articles in the Yale Law Journal in 1913. And the real genius of Hofeld's analysis was his recognition that we often use the term right to mean quite different kinds of essentially relationships among persons. And that alone is significant, since it led him to reject the common notion, commonly accepted, that one could have a right to say something, for example, an iPhone, which is a relationship between you and your phone. Your ownership of that phone, right, is on that view a relationship between you and that thing. But on Hofeld's view, and I think on the correct view, that's not really true. It's, in fact, a relationship between you and everyone else relative to that thing. You don't have a relationship to that thing that constitutes a moral. It's not a moral relationship. You have a relationship to other persons. that concern that thing. So rights are, on this view, on Hofeld's view, first and foremost, kinds of relationships. They describe relationships between persons. In fact, they are three-term relations between one person, one or more other particular persons, and something or some act description. If you want to say basic, what's the basic meaning of a right? It seems to be it's that. It's a three-term relation between one person, one or more other persons, and something or act description. Second, however, and also quite important, Hofeld distinguishes four meanings that sometimes are ascribed to a right. So in other words, people often use one word right to mean one of four different things. And it's important to be clear that there is a difference. The first of these he called a claim right. And this is a right in the strongest terms because a claim right indicates the existence of a specific correlative duty. Often that's the basic way that somebody explains the meaning of a right. They say you have a right if someone else has an obligation to you. And that is true of this type of right. It's true of a claim right. It's not necessarily true of other kinds of rights, as we'll see. The most common case of claim rights in law involve things like contracts. If you agree to sell me your house, then we have a certain relationship. Once I've paid the money, or more likely secured a loan from a bank, I have a claim right to the house, and you have an obligation to provide it. Similarly, you have a claim right to payment, and I have an obligation to pay. This is true of claim rights, but not all of the relationships that we refer to as rights are claim rights. The second sort of right Hofeld distinguished was what he called a liberty right. In fact, he called it a privilege, but that complicates things a bit, so I'm just going to call it a liberty right. A liberty right of some kind indicates the absence of any operative claim right on the part of someone else. I have a liberty right to knock out the wall between my kitchen and my dining room if I want to, in my house. But I had no similar right when I lived in an apartment, since the apartment complex's owners forbade such things in the lease that I signed. So they had a claim right against my physically altering the structure of the apartment in any way. No one has such a claim right to my house. They had a claim right against my doing certain things to the apartment. This is an important category, since we are often said to have rights that are really only liberties and entail no obligation on anyone else's part. I may want to knock down the wall, and I may have a liberty right to do so in my own house, but maybe I lack the means. I don't know how to knock down walls. I don't have enough money to pay a contractor to come and do it, in which case I have a liberty right to do it, but there isn't anybody who has an obligation that will make it happen. A third kind of right, Hofeld called a power right. Power here means the power to perform some act with legal effect, especially the sort of effect that might alter the legal position of another person. I have a power if I'm under no legal liability from another party. I have the power, for example, to make a will, which could alter the legal position of my natural heirs. Spouses have powers over one another's legal positions. Similarly, adults have the power to enter into binding contracts of various kinds with one another. Finally, the fourth kind of relationship that Hofeld discusses is an immunity, meaning that one's legal position cannot be altered by the power of another person. I have, for example, an immunity from being required to testify against my wife in criminal proceedings against her. Some of the rights that make up the Bill of Rights appended to the United States Constitution then, in fact, some of the most important ones, are really immunities. You can recognize this from the very language of some of those articles in the Constitution. Congress shall make no law, right? Those are the first words of the First Amendment to the Constitution. The most important aspect of Hofeld's analysis is that it presses one to state propositions about rights with great precision, a precision that is often missing from the sorts of claims that so annoyed George Will and chagrined Ambassador Glendon. In other words, if you follow this kind of an account, then what you have to do whenever you want to make a claim about a particular right is state with very great precision exactly what that claim is and why that right exists. Now, Hofeld was concerned with legal rights, not natural rights, but his analysis applies to natural rights as well. To claim that some natural right exists, one must, I think, be able to specify who holds the right against whom, over what matters, and whether the right in question is a claim right, a liberty, a power, or an immunity. I'll come back to this, but first I want to say something about the more general ground of rights. Contemporary political and legal philosophers have tended to explain the existence of rights according to one of two theories. I'm talking about contemporary legal philosophers. The so-called benefit or interest theory of rights holds that rights are to be explained by reference to a benefit owed by one person to another or some person's interest that must be protected. This theory was most famously defended by Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, and it's been championed most strongly by later utilitarians. The other theory is usually called the choice or will theory of rights, and it's close to the view of rights that I discussed earlier as a kind of individual sovereignty. The choice theorist holds that rights are really powers of individuals to make certain choices for themselves, free from interference from others, and that within their protected sphere, they are indeed sovereign. The choice theorists reject the benefit theory because they think it really isn't a theory of rights at all, since rights in the benefit or interest theory aren't doing any of the real work, but operate more like reflexes of the benefit or the interest in question, which is really primary. The most well-known recent theorist of the choice theorist, advocate of the choice theory, was H.L.A. Hart. Some of you may have heard of Hart, but probably most of you haven't. H.L.A. Hart was probably the most famous legal philosopher in the English-speaking world of the second half of the 20th century. Interestingly, H.L.A. Hart partly changed his view of rights based on a criticism of the choice or will theory made by the Scottish legal philosopher Neil McCormick. Neil McCormick was a professor at the, might have been the University of Edinburgh. Anyway, he had the greatest university chair that I've ever heard of. He was the Regius Professor of the Law of Nature and of Nations. If I could have any academic chair, I would have. But time is growing short, and they have not offered it to me yet. McCormick favored the benefit theory, the so-called benefit theory of rights, and he suggested a counterexample to the choice theory that Hart could not explain, namely the rights of children. Children below the age of majority have no legal powers in their own names. For example, a child can't make a contract, a binding contract with another person. A child can't make a will. They don't have the ordinary legal powers that adults have. And yet, most people do seem to think that children have some legal rights. If this is so, then the rights of children simply cannot be explained by the choice or will theory of rights, but they can be explained, McCormick held, by the benefit or interest theory. Hart was forced to concede the point, and so he abandoned the view that moral rights, the most important moral rights, including what were considered, well, what are usually constitutionalized as the most basic human rights in most countries, could be explained by the choice theory, although he maintained that most explicitly legal rights could be so explained. In the case of the most important moral rights, Hart suggested that their basis could only be located in some very basic human needs. Now, both Hart and McCormick's view of rights are modern, basically liberal views. They are both grounded in a kind of individualism. Moreover, McCormick's view, which is in many respects preferable, I think, is also tied to a kind of utilitarianism that is problematic for reasons I can't go into here. My purpose in mentioning them has mainly been to show that the question of why there are any rights remains a disputed question. I now want to sketch out the sort of alternative understanding of rights that can be developed, I think, out of Thomistic principles. So this is the third part of my talk. In thinking about a Thomistic account of natural rights, we have to face up to the problem I mentioned earlier. There simply is no full-dress theory of natural rights in the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas. There is no question or even article in the Summa Theologiae where he spells this out. Now, this has led many to say that this is because it is a modern notion associated with thinkers like John Locke. Aquinas, this objection goes, has natural law. Locke has natural rights. Rights are individual powers. Laws are constraints. One obvious way around this is to say that natural rights are derived in some way from natural law, that natural law is primary, start with natural law, but that natural rights can be derived from natural law. So, for example, Aquinas clearly thinks that we have a duty to worship God. In fact, a natural duty. It's not a duty that's that comes from a theological virtue, but it's part of the natural virtue of justice. So Aquinas thinks we have a duty to worship God. Therefore, since we have this duty, it follows that we also have a right to worship God. Since, as we all know, ought implies can. I think this is true, but I don't think it gets us very far. This explains a few rights, but it doesn't explain lots of others. Moreover, it's those who contrast rights and law reject the idea that the former can be derived from the latter, partly because they see rights as mainly a kind of power, the individual sovereignty that I mentioned, and that could not be rooted in a duty because it is the opposite of a duty. One reason for the impasse here is, I think, an erroneously narrow understanding of what Aquinas meant by natural law. Natural law is, on Aquinas' view, one of four kinds of law that he famously distinguished in the Summa Theologiae, in the first part of the second part, so the moral section, in question 91, which is an early part of the so-called Treatise on Law. So he distinguishes four kinds of law there. Law as such, so the general basic category of law there, is famously defined as, quote, an ordinance of reason, ordinatio rationis, directed to the common good and promulgated by whoever has the care of the community, right? So that's his famous four-part definition of law that Thomas has. Now, it is important that ordinance, ordinatio, right, which is the first thing that he mentions, first off, a law is an ordination of some kind, an ordinatio. It's important that ordinatio can mean a good bit more than simply an order or a command. It can and often does mean a kind of order. It is also important that punishment is not a part of Aquinas' definition of law. He later refers to it as an act of law, but it is not part of his essential definition of law. In both of these things, Thomas's account of law is very different from modern positivist definitions of law that tend to assimilate laws to commands made on pain of sanctions. In question 91, Thomas tells us that there are four kinds of law. There's first of all eternal law, which refers to God's providential government of the whole universe. It may seem strange to call this law, but it has all the characteristics assigned to law in the definition from question 90. It is rational, since God himself is the measure of reason. It is directed to the common good of the whole universe. And it issues from the one who cares for the whole community of creation, that is to say, God. Now, the third aspect in the definition of law, promulgation, may seem a bit sticky here. The eternal law resides first in God's mind. And we have no direct access to God's mind, so how could it be promulgated? Aquinas holds that it is promulgated in three somewhat unusual ways. He mentions promulgation in the Word and the Book of Life. Promulgation in the Word, I take it, refers to the second person of the Trinity, Christ. Since God is three persons, there is a sense in which God promulgates the eternal law to himself. The Book of Life is a reference to the biblical book, Revelation, which refers to a book in which are written the names of those who are saved, indicating thereby, unfortunately, also those who are damned. Those names are not there. So this is a reference to God's foreknowledge. Most importantly for our purposes, however, is a third sense in which the eternal law is promulgated. Thomas calls the second kind of law natural law, and he defines it as the rational creature's participation in the eternal law. Man participates in God's providential government of things through his own created nature, which is distinguished by the power of free deliberate choice. Human beings are the causes of their own acts, and it is precisely in this sense that human beings are images of God. We share in God's providential government through our free will, which is directed by reason. So the eternal law is promulgated to us through the nature that God gave us in creation. The natural law, then, is also law, in that it is also an ordinance of reason, directed to the common good and promulgated by one who has the care of the community. It is therefore law because it shares those four elements of law. And it is natural because it is promulgated to us through our created human nature, which is rational nature. So it's promulgated precisely through reason, which is the distinguishing power of human beings. We humans are the causes of our own actions through our powers of deliberate choice. Now, Aquinas, like Aristotle, held that every action is for the sake of some good. So these acts that we choose are chosen in pursuit of goods that are goods for us precisely because of the natures that we have. Aquinas says in Question 94, Article 2, that we act for the sake of life. We act for the sake of offspring. We act for the sake of knowledge. We even act for the sake of social life itself, for the community with other persons. These are natural goods for human beings, and the natural law contains precepts that are related to the pursuit of these natural goods. The natural law, then, is Aquinas' way of referring to the intelligibility of human action. It is a participation in the eternal law because the eternal law controls all movements in the universe. The natural law is concerned with the human part and describes our movement through free deliberate choices towards our good. Human beings pursue the natural goods through their natural abilities or powers, like thinking and locomotion. Those powers work best when they are rightly disposed towards their objects, and the right disposition of those powers is what Aquinas calls virtues. In the same question 94, he says that the natural law includes the acts that are in accordance with all the virtues. So virtue, too, is part of the natural law. We could see now that there is a rather simple synonym for natural law: morality. Basically, what Thomas means by natural law is our ordinary understanding of the moral obligations of human beings. Now, I've gone into some detail about Thomas's understanding of natural law because part of the challenge of thinking about natural rights from a Thomistic perspective is the opposition so commonly drawn between natural law on the one hand and natural rights on the other. But if by natural law Thomas means morality, the deliberate pursuit by human beings of their good through rational action, then I do not see how there must be any such opposition. The view I described before holds that natural law is all about constraint and natural rights are all about freedom. This is surely wrong. The natural law for Aquinas is just as much about freedom as are natural rights. And if this is the case, then there is simply no inconsistency between the two, and no bar to seeing the latter as somehow derived from the former. If natural rights are moral rights, if they're part of morality, then they must be part of the natural law. What else could they be? We are most accustomed to thinking about morality in terms of rules, and there are moral rules. Aquinas holds that the Ten Commandments are themselves precepts of the natural law. But virtues are also part of morality, and so are also part of the natural law, and so too are rights, at least natural rights. So one of the things that makes Thomas's moral theory sometimes challenging to teach is that it's highly complicated. You know, I mean, you can put a lot of the kind of standard moral theories on a bumper sticker if you want to, morally right is what promotes the greatest happiness of the greatest number. That's your utilitarian bumper sticker. You put that on a little tiny European car and you're all set. If you say always act according to a maxim that you can will to be a universal law, right, that's your deontological Kantian bumper sticker. You have to make somewhat smaller type that increases the possibility that people are going to tailgate you because they want to read it. But if you're a Kantian, it's worth the risk, I think. The problem with Aquinas' moral theory, or maybe it's the virtue of Aquinas' moral theory, is that there is no bumper sticker version of it, right? I mean, and there have been quarrels about it where sometimes, you know, this a movement where people come in and say, well, actually, Thomas is, he's a virtue ethics guy. Well, he is a virtue ethics guy. So, well, no, he's a natural law guy. Well, he is a natural law guy. He's all of those things because those are all elements of the natural law and his understanding of it. So now if what I've just argued is right, then natural rights are derived from natural law and in fact ultimately derived from eternal law. But I've not said anything about how natural rights can be so derived. I think that from a Thomistic perspective, we can see natural rights as derived from principles of natural law in at least two ways. One way is fairly straightforward. Life is one of the natural goods distinguished by Aquinas in question 94, article 2. And he says there is a natural law precept that commands us to respect human life. Later, in the second part of the Summa, Thomas holds that the intentional killing of human beings is permissible in only two cases, the killing of criminals by political authorities and the killing of enemy soldiers in a just war. The intentional killing of innocent persons is, Thomas says, always illicit, always forbidden. If Smith is an innocent person, then Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, certainly not to kill him. Now remember Hofeld, the existence of a duty, if there is a duty there in a full sense, implies a correlate right, a correlate claim right. If Jones has a duty to respect Smith's life, along with everyone else's, so the duty is generalized, then Smith has a right to his life. Commands in this way can entail rights. Aquinas also holds that reproduction and the care of offspring are natural goods for human beings, and that natural law precepts follow from this. One such precept, I think, is the following. Parents have a duty to educate their children. Children thus have a correlate claim right to an education, a kind of claim right relative to their parents. Here then are two natural rights. Now those who reject the derivation of natural rights from natural law won't much like this. Their response would likely be that in the examples I just gave, the real work is not being done by rights, but by duties. The rights are mere reflexes of prior obligations, just the sort of criticism that advocates of the choice theory of rights make against the benefit or interest theorists. The force of the criticism rests on the sense that here, the right is really just parasitic on the duty, has no moral force of its own, but is simply a kind of consequence. I'm not sure that's right, at least in these two cases. I think that circumstances may well make one take notice of the right first and the duty only later. One can well imagine, for example, seeing a neglected child and feeling here is a human being deprived of what is her right, which she herself may not know at all, and only later, as a consequence, feeling a kind of indignation at the failure of her parents to perform a duty. There is, however, another aspect to this and another worry from those who think rights cannot be derived from law. The term that we translate as right from Aquinas' Latin is the word jus. It is the root of the word justus, justitia. Justice for Aquinas is first and foremost the name of a virtue and only secondarily a name for a state of affairs or a situation of some kind. The virtue of justice is defined by him as, quote, the perpetual and constant will to render to each his jus. Jus is also related to the term justum, which means the just thing or the right thing to do. And this last, according to Aquinas, means, justum, a relationship between persons, a kind of adjustment between them. He divides jus as a relationship between persons into two kinds, jus naturale, natural right, and jus positivum, or positive right. So jus naturale literally means natural right, although crucially here it means again a relationship, one that is a function of nature itself. And Aquinas gives two examples of this. One concerns a kind of equivalent value for things, for example, in a trade, where you trade one thing for another thing that seems to be of equal value in some sense. But the second, which is more interesting, is the relationship between parents and children. The relationship between parents and children is natural in the strictest sense. The children literally come from the bodies of the parents in a strictly natural process, and their relationship is always a function of this natural relationship, natural bodily relationship, in fact. Positive right, on the other hand, is the function of some kind of agreement among people. It's not natural in that sense. It doesn't follow naturally in the sense that the rights between parents and children does. It follows on some kind of an agreement. It could be a private agreement, could be a public agreement. In between natural rights, like those that exist between parents and children, and positive rights that are just the subject of agreement, is a third category that Aquinas, following the Roman lawyers, calls jus gentium, the right of peoples or the right of nations. This is a form of right or relationship that isn't strictly natural, like that of parents and children, but it follows very quickly from reason about nature. The main example Thomas gives here is the right to private property. That individual persons own particular things is not naturally right, it's not strictly naturally right, because there is no natural relationship between any one person and anything in the world. In contrast to the clear natural relationship between parents and children, rather, property is the result of social agreement and laws. Now, the fact of human nature suggests that private ownership is the best way to arrange property relations among persons under most circumstances, so most human societies have this institution, but it is a step removed from nature itself. This suggests that there are some claims of right that individuals can make on the basis of nature. Natural rights in the strongest sense, like the right to life, the right to be cared for by one's parents. There are other rights that are rather close to being natural rights, but they are a step removed from them and clasped under this right of nations or jus gentium, for example, the rights to the fruit of one's labors. Finally, there are all kinds of rights, potentially innumerable rights, that are arrived at by public and private agreement and thus a part of positive right. For example, the right to make a contract, the right to make a will, the right to an attorney, the right to vote. One more wrinkle here. Remember that jus, for Aquinas, I said, is the object of justice. The virtue of justice is the will to render to each person his use, to give to each person that which is that person's right. Aquinas follows Aristotle in seeing different parts of the virtue of justice, that there are different subcategories of the virtue of justice. He says that one kind of justice, legal justice, directs one's actions to the common good. There's also something he calls particular justice, which directs one's acts relative to other persons. Particular justice is itself divided between what he calls distributive justice, which concerns distributions from goods that are common to the community to individuals, and commutative justice, which directs one in one's relationship with others, for example, buying things and selling things, but also compensating other people for losses or injuries that they might suffer, and even punishment that's given to criminals. The two types of particular justice are particular relative to legal justice. So even those two are related to the common good. The idea of the common good is obviously important here. It's a big topic, and I just want to make two very brief remarks about it. First, A common good is a good that is shareable, and the good that is most common and most shareable for Aquinas is the final and universal good of the whole cosmos, God. But the political community itself is also a kind of common good, what is sometimes called the temporal or political common good. For Thomas, of course, the temporal common good is subject to the universal or ultimate common good. And so one's relationship in justice to that good transcends politics. For Aquinas, religio, religion, is the name of a virtue related to justice. It disposes one to give to God what is God's jus, which is worship. This would be, for Aquinas, the basis of the natural right to religious freedom. Finally, very briefly, a conclusion. In conclusion, I want to admit to you that the modern rights theorist will not likely be persuaded by what I have just said, for a reason that you have perhaps anticipated. If a right is a kind of individual sovereignty, a zone of freedom in which one's choices are entirely a function of one's will, then the Thomistic account of natural rights, as I have suggested, is not an account of rights in this sense. It is, a modern theorist would say, an account of right in the singular, which is not a protected zone of individual sovereignty, but a kind of objective relationship between persons, one in which duties and the common good play a major role. Nothing I have said will convince him otherwise, nor in a sense should it. In the end, there is a divide between the Thomistic account I have given, and which I think is the sober truth, and the modern understanding of rights, one that goes right back to Thomas Jefferson with his trinity of Bacon, Newton, and Locke. This was not Aquinas' trinity. For Aquinas, natural right and natural law are ways in which we are ordered to our final ends in the universal good that is God. For Jefferson and his successors, not least the judges who signed on to the majority opinion in the Casey decision, we are our own ends and thus our own sovereigns. Sovereign individuals who must nevertheless get by together. There is no getting around this difference. But, and this is my final point, when we think of the most important human rights, what Aquinas would call natural rights, things like the right to life, to care and upbringing, the right not to be tortured, the right to worship freely, we think of ways in which those rights are protected by the institutions and practices of modern political and legal systems. Institutions are often related to theories, but they are not the same as theories. And the same institutions can be upheld and maintained on the basis of more than one theoretical account. I think that modern theories of rights as the individual sovereignty of persons who are their own ends is mistaken, and often leads to just the problems with which I began. But unlike some of those who have noted these problems, I do not believe that the remedy is to repudiate the notion of natural or human rights. The protections they afford to human persons against the terrible power of modern states is too important. The remedy is to explain them and improve them on the basis of a better theory. St. Thomas Aquinas did not produce a theory of human rights, but his moral and political thought contained the materials out of which a better theory can be constructed. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.